You are listening to a crossover, No Fair Remembering Stuff, / Science Fiction University edition, though we are entitled No Fair Remembering Who Won the Very First Nebula Award for Best Novel in 1966. And this is the Professional Left Podcast, which is available wherever you get your podcasts and at our website, proleftpod.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a Patreon button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at the Professional Left Podcast, P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
We went to see the Dune 2 movie.
Yes, we did. We had a blast. But it's been a minute since we did our episode comparing the adaptation of three science fiction classics to film and television, Dune, Foundation, and Kindred. And wouldn't you know it, that scamp Denis Villeneuve went out and finished the second half of his massive project to bring the first Dune novel to the screen. And it has become big enough phenomena to be considered, you know, news with a capital N. And how news is it?
Well, it's news enough to warrant a long, catty review by Justin Chang in The New Yorker. Because what kind of a world would it be without a critic harping on the, quote, aggressively beige and brutalist version of Herbert's cosmos, unquote?
Yeah.
Dismissing the movie as merely proficient, Justin Chang writes, quote, Paul, as part of his Fremen assimilation, must master the extreme sport of worm riding, which is a bit like windsurfing, a bit like rock climbing, and a hell of a thing to witness. Tellingly, it's only in this glorious burst of spectacle, backed by the mighty surge of Hans Zimmer's score, that Dune Part 2 rises above proficiency and flirts with transcendence, unquote.
Jeez.
Chang is generally unhappy about the grubby profitability of the whole enterprise. Quote, those of us who retain a stubborn fondness for Lynch's much maligned adaptation will sense what's missing from Villeneuve's: an imaginative density, a hint of psychoerotic danger, the grotesque teeming aliveness of a fully inhabited world. Not that it will trouble anyone's sleep, least of all the heads that rule over House Hollywood. The only world that matters here is the one that this Dune, a box office messiah, has already conquered. Power over spice is power over all, unquote.
Yeah. Jesus.
Yeah, that's just tiresome.
Yeah, but it's in The New Yorker, honey.
It's in The New Yorker.
Then there's Esther Zuckerman of The New York Times, who, quote, can't believe the New York Times let me write about my obsession with the Dune popcorn bucket and why I think it's a throwback to the halcyon days of dumb movie merch, unquote.
That popcorn bucket is a thing.
It is a thing. But, you know, really? New York Times is handing out assignments over popcorn buckets, which makes me think they have a lot.
They want an article about the popcorn bucket.
They have a lot of time on their hands. They
can
be spending other things.
And money to spend on that kind of thing. Yes.
But this means that Dune 2 is news with a capital N, and it's science fiction. And as science fiction aficionados, we felt it was our duty as the deans of Science Fiction University and No Fair Remembering Stuff to hop on a Space and Guild transport back to beautiful Arrakis and talk about what the hell's going on down there.
Now, we have both seen the 1984 David Lynch disaster. We've both read the novel. You've read the novel. We have listened to it together on audiobook.
Yes, we have. I've read the first four novels. Didn't go through the rest of them, but I read the first four. Although a search of the books still boxed up in our basement wouldn't prove that. I also watched the three-part 2000 miniseries entitled Frank Herbert's Dune and the 2003 sequel miniseries entitled Frank Herbert's Children of Dune, which adapted the second and third novels of the series. This was back when the Sci-Fi Channel was spelling itself SCIFI, and these were among the highest rated programs ever to be broadcast on that channel. So, if you want to see the Dune story in greater depth and detail, and want to impress your friends by knowing in advance what Villeneuve's Dune Messiah will be all about, you can try to hunt down the miniseries. The first few episodes, actually all three episodes of Frank Herbert's Dune, is available on YouTube. And all episodes of both miniseries are supposed to be available on Amazon Prime, but I can't find them. They're also supposed to be up on a subscription thing called Hoopla, but I couldn't find them there either. So maybe just stick to the books. Every used bookstore has these books.
Yep. Now, we both saw Dune Part 1 in a nearly empty theater when it was first released. And we have rewatched it recently, as most podcasters talking about Dune 2 have done. I agree. It's not the same on the small screen, but it was good to review it.
Oh, just FYI, if you're wondering, it picks up almost exactly where the first movie left off.
Yeah. I predict that the next movie will do the same thing.
Yeah. It kind of has to.
Yeah. Both of us went to see Dune 2 the day it was released. So trust us when we tell you. It's awesome.
Awesome.
I think it's the greatest epic film I've ever seen. Is it better than Revenge? No, Empire Strikes Back. Is it better than Empire Strikes Back? Yes, it is. I think it is.
Yes, it is. Is it better than Wrath of Khan?
It's a movie for adults, for one thing. It's completely a movie for adults.
It absolutely is. And it really, really, it's finally the technology has caught up with the story.
Yeah, yeah. So we're here to talk about why we thought it worked, what it left out from the books, how the absence of certain plot points does change the trajectory of the story, but does not irrevocably damage it, really.
No, not really.
And what Villeneuve is going to have to clean up in Dune Messiah, because there's some stuff that kind of got left out that kind of needs to be brought back in if they're going to make these characters do what the novels did.
Uh-huh.
And so Dune Messiah is scheduled for 2027. Villeneuve made some choices, and we're going to talk about that.
And some of those choices can just sort of wander off in the desert and die. But some of those choices affect the downstream story pretty profoundly. So he's going to have to find a way to work them in. Now, first, since it has been a minute since we did our last Dune review, let's do a recap of the stuff we covered in Science Fiction University episode number 12, entitled Respect the Writer. Dune is a long and extremely complex novel that was thought by many to be unfilmable, and David Lynch's disastrous 1984 version seemed to prove that point. 36 years later, advances in filmmaking technology made it technically possible to put Frank Herbert's vision on the screen in a form that wouldn't send fans screaming into the streets, and director Denis Villeneuve very shrewdly decided not to try to gallop through the entire novel in one movie, but to break the 412-page novel in half, allowing the story to breathe and move at the right pace. Villeneuve also masterfully compacted the story of Spice into a very short descriptive montage. We know what the characters are fighting about and for early and quickly, and that's very important.
I think that was the most important and best decision he made.
Absolutely.
And he did it so well that... all the other things about this movie hang from his decision to tell you what Spice is about as succinctly as possible. And so you get the stakes of this movie immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unlike Agent Argyle, right?
Yeah.
Where apparently they change the stakes every 5 minutes in that movie.
Well, and
this is a decision he made. Villeneuve made a decision to say, we know what Spice is. We're going to tell you what Spice is.
Right.
And then we're going to move on and tell the story.
Because he's a super fan.
Yeah.
And so all of this is really familiar to him. All this, if you're a big Dune fan from way back, all this is familiar. But you got to remember, you're inviting people in who've never seen this thing before, never heard about it. And you're plopping them down in a completely alien world with a bunch of new people and new characters and new politics. So you got to be gentle. You got to let them in easy. And that's what he does, and it's really smart.
So let's look at how the director packs the first half of Dune into an almost 3-hour movie without pissing off fans or wrecking the plot. First, Dune is a very interior novel.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what is on the screen is what Paul and Jessica are thinking. In his 1984 version, David Lynch tried to solve this problem with voiceovers, which was a massive fail.
Yeah, didn't work.
Didn't work. Villeneuve worked to create exterior clues for what was going on inside people's heads.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked extremely well.
Yeah.
I think the time he spent working on the relationship between mother and son.
Yeah.
And her ability to sign to her son. And her role as teacher and also sort of how she spawned him, that you know, there's lots of problems with the fact that she had a son, and we'll get into that. But
yeah,
you know, her commitment to him and the pain that she feels when he feels pain and so forth. It's a very intense relationship, and he spends time building that relationship on the screen.
Yeah. And they also hired really good actors who know how to take
so amazing
the interior emotional territory and put it on their face and let you know what they're thinking, what's going on.
Yeah.
And it really does make a difference. It, hire a great actor and a great to play a great character is so important. Mm-hmm. Now, in the novel, the character Liet Kynes is a man who dies in the desert from dehydration. In the movies, Liet Kynes is a woman who's killed by the Emperor's Sardaukar super soldiers. As she dies, Kynes summons a sandworm which swallows her and her killers whole. This was a very clever way of telling viewers that even the Sardaukar are no match for the desert power of sandworms and Fremen.
Mm-hmm. And that's the first time you see the sandworm up close.
You just see the mouth. Movie. You just, the sand goes soft and liquidy, and suddenly these people just sink into a hole, and there's something real big that's creating that hole.
Going to eat it. Yeah, going to eat you. Yep. The introduction of Baron Harkonnen's nephew, Fade Rautho, was cut, pushed over into part two. And the role of the Mentats, the human computers that play a large role in the novel, is cut down to a few lines. Hmm. I mean, that was just a drastic decision made by Villeneuve. Details of the complex politics of Dune, the Spacing Guild and the Landsrat and the Missionaria Protectiva are mostly gone. Mm-hmm. And this makes Dune the movie safe for newcomers. You don't have to understand all those intricacies to enjoy this film.
Yeah, they will catch up with you in later films as they're made. But, you know, for example, there's a whole thing called the Butlerian Jihad, which is a robot war. It's if you ever watched Battlestar Galactica, same thing. Mm-hmm. There was a massive AI robot uprising somewhere in history. Human beings barely won. And since that time, it's been absolutely prescribed by religion. You're not allowed to make intelligent machines. So there's no computers anywhere. So you have to have a whole subgroup, a whole cohort of humans who are trained to think like computers and act like computers. Now, we also miss the details of a relationship between Lady Jessica and a character called Shoutout Mapes, who presents Jessica with a kris knife. This is a weapon that's made from the tooth of a sandworm, which must never be sheathed unblooded, according to the Fremen ritual. It's just something that we would have liked to have seen, and we noticed it when it was cut, but its absence doesn't really damage the plot in any way. But the most significant change from Dune the novel to Dune Part 1 the movie is the elimination of the first paragraph of the first page of the book, and all the subsequent epigraphs from, quote, and this is where spoilers come in. Okay. We're going to do a lot of spoiling. So everybody just get ready for spoilers. If you don't want spoilers, skip ahead, listen to our political podcast, but there's spoilers coming down the pike. The epigraphs are written by Paul Atreides' future wife that introduce each chapter in the novel. And from now on, as I said, a lot of spoilers coming your way for everything Dune related, Dune serial, Dune the movie, Dune
the popcorn
cartoon.
Box, yes.
Dune the Saturday morning cartoon. All the Dune stuff is going to get spoiled or may potentially be spoiled from now on. So if you don't want that to happen, just skip on by.
And I'm assuming that most of the listeners of the podcast are way familiar with Dune.
Yeah.
When we first did the podcast on Dune, I hadn't read Dune yet as a, 50 plus woman. And the emails I got about, why haven't you read this book yet? People weren't mean, but they were insistent. Like, your education has a huge hole in it because you haven't read Dune yet. So,
well, let's be clear, just between you and me and the three people listening to this, that part of this podcast is us being a little bit smug about having read everything related to Dune and seen all the stuff and stuff.
Well, you have, yeah.
Because a lot of the criticism is based on people who did not read the homework and are like, what happened here? Why is that happening? What's going on here? That doesn't make no sense. And we're like, yeah, we're the people who read we didn't do this. So we were sufficiently surprised. But it's like the people who read the entire Game of Thrones series and then watched as the audience who'd never seen it before going, oh, I'm sure they'll be happily married. Oh, my God.
And filmed their friends watching the Red Wedding because they knew what was coming.
So we kind of know what's coming. And yeah. we think probably most of you do too. But it's really interesting to see what a director who's got a complete vision of everything he wants to do knows that we're out here waiting to pounce.
Right.
And he's building a story that will satisfy us and make us go, okay, I understand
satisfy
why he did
him
that.
Too as a super exactly. fan. Because exactly. that's the thing. It mm-hmm. has to satisfy the director.
Exactly.
And that's what makes it a fun exercise to look at the choices that he made.
Absolutely.
And how he succeeded, because he really did succeed in this movie. All right, so Dune the novel opens like this. Quote, "A beginning is the time for taking the most delicate care that the balances are correct. This every sister of the Bene Gesserit knows. To begin your study of the life of Muad'Dib, then take care that you first place him in his time, born in the 57th year of the Padishah Emperor, Shaddam IV. And take the most special care that you locate Muad'Dib in his place, the planet Arrakis. Do not be deceived by the fact that he was born on Caladan and that lived his first 15 years there. Arrakis, the planet known as Dune, is forever his place. From Manual of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan." Unquote.
Now, if you listen carefully to that paragraph, it contains a lot of information. That there is an organization called the Bene Gesserit that will be important. That their form of government is an empire. It's ruled over by a person named Shaddam IV. And that the central player in the story will be this guy called Muad'Dib, right? Mm-hmm. But more important than that is the source of all this exposition, the Manual of Muad'Dib by someone named Princess Irulan. This is telling the reader how to read the novel. It tells the reader that in this universe, this man, Muad'Dib, is an historical character. That what they are about to read is a record of things long past, which have been sifted and studied and sorted and documented by future generations. The movie shifts this perspective completely. In the movie, the events are not a matter of historical record. Instead, we are with Paul and with Jessica as the narrative unfolds in real time.
Now, taking popular novels and turning them into good or great movies mm-hmm. requires this ability to see what's important for a visual medium and dispense with everything else. Legendary screenwriter William Goldman explains the most important element in screenwriting. Quote, "Screenplays are structure, and that's all they are. The quality of writing, which is crucial in almost every other form of literature, is not what makes a screenplay work. Structure isn't anything else but telling the story, starting as late as possible, starting each scene as late as possible. You don't want to begin with Once Upon a Time, because the audience gets antsy." Unquote.
Yep.
Now, Goldman wrote both the novel, A Princess Bride, and the film adaptation. And since he knew the difference between reading a book and watching a movie, he made lots of changes. In the book, this is hard to believe, but in the book, there is no grandfather.
What?
There's no Peter Falk at all. Not in the book. And the father spends about the first third of the novel trying to find the book, The Princess Bride, about Buttercup and Wesley. There's a search for the book in his book.
Mm-hmm.
Mario Puzo collaborated with Francis Ford Coppola to adapt his Godfather novel for the screen. And Driftglass and I tried to listen to the Godfather book, and we found it unlistenable.
Yeah, it's, no.
The Godfather movie, the first movie, ended up cutting more than two-thirds of the book and almost all of the melodrama and focusing on what makes the novel and the movie work. It's a family drama about immigrants and criminals and stirring the sauce.
Stir the sauce.
You got to stir the sauce and add a little bit of sugar.
A little bit of sugar. And that's my secret.
That's my secret.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the Mario Puzo novel is a potboiler.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about screwing for like 200 pages.
Yeah. And to be a really good director, showrunner, whatever, you have to have like x-ray vision. You got to be able mm-hmm. to look inside this massive thing and see the skeleton and see what absolutely has to be there to make the thing work. and then include the stuff that's necessary and exclude the things that you have to because of time or whatever reason. And you always make compromises. Like the showrunners and writers on Game of Thrones were faced with the same problem, right? When they had to streamline George R.R. Martin's massive epic down to fit into an HBO TV series. And for the most part, they chose pretty wisely, thanks in no small measure to the fact that the original writer of the novel, Martin, is still alive and still writing, and was still available to help them understand the long-term implications of the changes they were considering. So, let's get back to Dune Part 2. There are a lot of questions flying around, different podcasts. I'm looking at you, Midnight Boys. And printed media about what's going on in this movie from people who are, as we've mentioned before, unfamiliar with the source material. Good people, wonderful human beings all, I'm sure, but they're not sure about the foundation on which the movie's based. So they ask questions like, what the hell, man? Why did Paul kick his girlfriend Zendaya to the curb and marry that blonde chick? What's going on with that? And who is
you
this princess anyway?
You can't diss Zendaya, for gosh sakes.
What the hell's your problem? She just gets up and goes away at the end. She just hops on one rides off and he just exiles her and she's gone. What's the deal? I mean, didn't her father conspire to kill Paul's father and cause all this mess? The princess he's about to marry, isn't she part of a murder plot to kill Paul's father? Well, this is why your friends at Science Fiction University are here, to take you by the hand and answer those questions, which will include many, many spoilers, and examine the trade-offs the director had to make to fit this gigantic novel into two movies.
Now, first, a little background. Of all the centers of power that play a part in the Dune saga, none of them even vaguely resemble democracy.
Yeah.
The Empire as a whole is a hereditary aristocracy ruled by an emperor. Then there are the great houses, in which there are dukes and barons and princes and princesses and titles and properties that are handed down within royal families. One of the houses, House Harkonnen, whose homeworld is Gedi Prime, is run as a decadent, totalitarian police state. The House Atreides is run as an enlightened, aristocratic dictatorship. The Bene Gesserit order is a self-governing theocracy, which serves, and I wouldn't even say theocracy, it's not clear what God is. It's more a matriarchal religious sect.
Yes, I think that's correct, yeah.
And so they serve the empire, but pursue their own political agenda. Mm-hmm. And the Fremen of Arrakis, you'd think that they might be democratic. But they actually operate under a form of interlocking tribal communism in which all actions are taken for the good of the whole and the tribe owns everything collectively, including the water they reclaim from the bodies of the dead.
Yeah, this is not a heroic story of breaking the aristocracy and establishing a democracy across the galaxy. Mm-hmm. That is not what happens in this story. So don't look for that to be the outcome of any of these movies. The other
and I
two
did get a sense, Driftglass, from reading that New Yorker review, that the reviewer was really upset that somehow the filmmaker had not made a specific political connection between the Fremen and the Palestinians.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he didn't use the word jihad, and he didn't use the word, and it's like, it's not, it's written in 1966, first of all, and it's not about your political goals, right?
Today, your political goals today. It is about exploitation of indigenous people for their resources by colonists.
And that's
absolutely
true. And you can make connections, absolutely. You can make connections from that,
But it's also, they don't use the word jihad, but they do use the word crusade. And he made a big deal of that. And you know what? The word crusade is also used in the novel. It's pretty much interchangeable. So, you know, if that's where you want to go with your criticism, that's fine. That's why the New Yorker exists. So people like that can have a place. But that my concern right now is the elements of the plot and the major sources of power that make this story happen. Because this is a story in which nobody has any freedom of action. Almost no one has any choices. Mm-hmm. The two other major players, power sources, which are either barely mentioned or not mentioned at all in the Villeneuve movies are the Spacing Guild and Chome. Now, the Spacing Guild has a monopoly on interstellar shipping. Without the guild, all imperial commerce ceases. A civilization collapses. Everything's over. The guild depends on a mutated form of human being, which can see into the future clearly enough to pilot ships through the galaxy safely at faster than light speeds. And these guild navigators can only function while floating in a cloud of refined, Arrakis spice. No spice, no navigators. No navigators, no guild. No shipping. That's why spice is the most important thing in the universe. The other power center, CHOM, stands for Combine Honet Ober Advancer Mercantiles. So that will not be on the quiz, so you don't need to write that down. It's a giant galactic corporate monopoly that controls all forms of commerce across the empire. Anything manufactured anywhere, practically legally or illegal, is governed by CHOM, and CHOM directorships are the key to wealth and influence within imperial houses. The more your directorship is worth, the more money you have to do your stuff within your great house. So everybody got that? That's important, but it's not important to this conversation. And you can see why Villeneuve did not bother getting bogged down with the details of, you know, imperial commerce and taxes, because before you know it, your movie becomes The Phantom Menace.
Yeah, and let's talk about trade routes and the empire.
Is the taxation fair? Are these trade considerations? Nobody wants to sit and listen to that for, you know, 2 hours, which is a terrible
mistake. 2 minutes.
2 minutes. So he said, you know what? We're just going to bypass all that, and that'll be in the supplementary material for you nerds who want to read about it.
And by the way, speaking of all the Phantom Menace, have you noticed or have not noticed how much George Lucas lifted from Dune to make Star Wars?
Yeah.
If you haven't noticed that, you haven't been paying attention. There's a desert planet, a reluctant hero who will be moved to action only after his family is killed by the evil empire. Who will learn the ways of an ancient religion, rise to become the leader of that religion, take on the evil empire using his special powers. Then he'll find out that he is related to the villain of the story. Come on.
What? Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, he owes Frank Herbert $5.
At least $5. The estate of Frank Herbert, $5.
Please pay Frank Herbert $5. Anyway, keep in mind that in Dune, the careful manipulation of genetic lines is the central project of the Bene Gesserit. They've been at it for centuries and have worked across the galaxy in every culture to implant the mythology of a messiah who will arrive with special prescient powers. Their breeding program is designed to manufacture that messiah. They're going to create it through births.
Mm-hmm.
And that messiah will be controlled by them and will fulfill the prophecy that they created.
Mm-hmm.
And may I say, Charlotte Rampling, acting with a thick veil over her face, and you still see all of the emotion and fear and anger and manipulation going on, shows, you know, a very good casting decision right there.
And you know who knows that all of this is bullshit, that it's all a story, that it's all made up, that it's all a myth, that it's all a plot by these Bennett? Paul knows it.
Yes.
Paul knows it perfectly well because he was raised in it. He discovered it the hard way. And his girlfriend, Shani, knows it. She and the young members of the tribe that he joins are all like, this is all bullshit. This is a story. This is
they believe it in the South, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, they believe it in the South.
Speak of it like it's Alabama.
Yeah, because they're fanatics down there. You know, can't you tell by their accent they're from the South? And they're very clear. This is a story. This is how they manipulate us. They're on to the plot. They're on to the scheme. The story of a Messiah is how they manipulate us. It's how they control us, which is 100% true. They have figured this shit out. But the breeding program has continued, and it's nearing a point of success. But by giving her Duke a son instead of a daughter, because she loved her Duke and he asked her to, despite the fact that she's a Bene Gesserit adept and witch, Jessica screwed all that up. Not irreparably. The Bene Gesserit have several possible genetic lines all lined up as backups, but it was a setback. So, as we mentioned above, the most significant change from Dune the novel to Dune the movie is the elimination of that first paragraph of the first page of the book and all the subsequent epigraphs. These are all written by that blonde chick, Princess Irulan, who will go on to become Paul's wife and his official chronicler. She is literally the very first character introduced in the novel on page one. But getting back to the critics and the people who asking questions about this movie in social media, why did Paul abandon his girlfriend Shani in order to marry this bitch? What the hell's going on? This is a really important plot point and something that Mr. Villeneuve is going to have to clean up quickly and work into the next movie. The reason this happened was to cement his control of the empire after deposing the emperor. Paul needs to take the emperor's daughter, the Princess Irulan, as his wife. This is how political arranged marriages work. This is how dynasties are maintained. This is how peace between feuding royal families is brokered. This is how the Romans did it. This is how pre-war World War I royal houses in Europe did it. And this is how the royal houses on Dune do it.
And in Dune, the book, Chani understands these political realities.
Mm-hmm. She's not happy about them, but she understands them.
Yeah. Paul reassures her, quote, "I swear to you now that you'll need no title. That woman over there will be my wife and you but a concubine, because this is a political thing. And we must weld peace out of this moment. Enlist the great houses of the Landstrad. We must obey the forms. Yet that princess will have no more of me than my name, no child of mine, nor touch, nor softness of glance, nor instant of desire," unquote. But Chani still has her doubts. After all, Irulan is the hot blonde princess, and she is a desert woman, still dirty and stained from combat. Quote, "So you say now," Chani said. She glanced across the room at the tall princess, unquote. Then Jessica, you know, the future mother-in-law of everybody, right, mm-hmm. chimes in and says, quote, "Do you know so little of my son?" Jessica whispered, "See that princess standing there, so haughty and confident? They say she has pretensions of a literary nature. Let us hope she finds solace in such things. She'll have little else." A bitter laugh escaped Jessica. "Think on it, Chani. That princess will have the name, yet she'll live as less than a concubine, never to know a moment of tenderness from the man to whom she's bound. While we, Chani, we who carry the name of concubine, history will call us wives."
Mm-hmm.
Unquote.
Very, very important, and none of that is in the movie. And that is from the first book. That's from the book Dune. So, you know, I was kind of expecting that to be in the movie that covers the book Dune.
Well, I predict that that's the opening scene of the next movie.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that that's just, you know, it's just a cliffhanger, and I respect
Jessica
cliffhanging.
Jessica talking to Chani is the opening of the next movie.
You know, I'm a concubine. I bore my Duke's children. You'll be his concubine, but you're more of a wife to him than she will ever be, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and he loves you.
And
before he will love you to his dying breath.
Yeah. Right. And he's said that, and he's sworn that several times, and he means it. He's crazy about you. And before we talk about the few other very important events that were left out of the movie, we should talk about those events, why those events were probably left out, what caused them to be omitted. And it comes down to a matter of pacing and the runtime of both movies. The pace of events in both parts one and part two make it seem like everything that happens, from the Atreides landing on Arrakis to the outbreak of open war with the Harkonnens to Paul rising to become the leader of the Fremen and leading them into battle, all that's taking place over a matter of several months, or maybe a year, maybe 2 years. But in the novel, all these things take place over a much longer period of time. In the novel and in the miniseries, for example, it's made clear that Baron Harkonnen's plan to destroy the Atreides is actually slow and methodical. He plans to let the Duke, he wants to let the Duke restore spice production, and in doing so, become even more popular. Why would he do that? Well, his thick-headed nephew doesn't understand why the Baron doesn't get in there and smash the Duke right now, kill him now. And the Baron has to explain exasperatedly to his dumb nephew that there is an art to this kind of vendetta. It's called Canley in the book. Letting the Duke succeed now will lull him into a false sense of security. And he'll lower his guard. And the Duke's increasing popularity, he'll be very popular, will make the other great houses hate and resent and fear him. And when the time comes, that will make it easier for them to go along with getting rid of him. Now, we know early on there's a traitor in the Duke's household, but we don't know who it is. The other part of the Baron's plan is to sow dissent among the senior members of the House of Treaties so that nobody trusts anybody. So that by the end, everyone suspects everyone else and they all turn on each other, which again will make it even easier to kill off the Duke and his family.
Now, after the House of Atreides falls and everyone assumes they are all dead, it takes a year or two just for the Harkonnens to restore spice production and begin their war against the Fremen. In the book, the war itself lasts 6 years. The Harkonnens are destroyed in 3 years, but the war does not officially end until 3 years after that, when Paul deposes the emperor and takes the throne. You can see this is taking over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie, all of these things seem to happen very quickly, and that compressed time frame didn't leave room for a number of very important plot points from the book.
Mm-hmm.
One minor change is that the scene in the novel where Lady Jessica finds a coded message from a fellow Bene Gesserit warning her of the broad outlines of the Baron's plans. There is a traitor. There will be an attempt on Paul's life. The message was left by Margot Lady Fenrig. I'm sorry, it's Fenring, right?
Yeah.
The consort of Lord Fenring, who was the Emperor's representative on Arrakis before the Atreides arrived. There is a whole Lord Fenring subplot that was dropped for the sake of time.
Yeah. And we don't miss it. It's interesting, and read the novel if you like. But however, the compression of time frame leads to two other fairly significant departures from the novel that we need to mention now. The first is that Paul's sister, Aaliyah, who in the movie is just a fetus, just an embryo, mm-hmm. floating around in a placental sac, talking to her mom and having her mom talk to her. Aaliyah was actually born during the Arrakis War and was fully born fully awake and aware with all the ancestral memories that had come to her mother, Jessica, during the Water of Life ceremony. That's why everybody freaked out when they discovered she was pregnant after she'd taken the Water of Life. Like, oh, crap. That's bad. That's very bad. But Aaliyah had no personality of her own to keep all those ancestral ghosts in check, so they overwhelm her. In the novel, remember in the movie, I think it's Paul who cuts the Baron's oxygen thing or whatever, mm-hmm, the pipes mm-hmm. he's using, or somebody does. He dies on the floor like a rat. He dies like a pig, you know, on the floor.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the novel, Aaliyah is the one who kills the Baron. She's alive. She is ambulatory. She does it as a 2-year-old. She gets close enough to stick him in the neck with a poison needle because who's afraid of a 2-year-old? So that's a fairly substantial change. She's born and she's active. She can't form words very well. But when she
is that a Bene Gesserit needle, like the one that is used in the putting your hand in the box ceremony, or is it some other kind of needle?
I think it's like I am the human gum jabbar or something. But
oh, okay.
Aaliyah is born an abomination.
I see.
She should never have been born because uh-huh. she doesn't have the personality to withstand the incredibly sinister ancestors that are lurking in the Atreides house past, who begin mm-hmm. to take her over and do fairly terrible things. So you have this little child, this 2-year-old, 3-year-old child saying really creepy adult things, which is mm-hmm. really hard to do special effects wise and child actor wise. It never worked in the David Lynch movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second big change, and it's really important, was that during the course of the war, Chani and Paul have a son. They have a kid during the war, during this novel. They have a kid named, they name him Leto II, and he is killed during a Sardaukar attack during the war.
Wow.
So as you can imagine, this adds a whole lot of weight to the moment when Paul announces that he's going to marry Princess Irulan and not Chani.
I would say so.
Yeah.
I'm the mother of your child, and right. you're going to go marry somebody else for politics.
Right.
Yeah.
Because Chani's not just his girlfriend. She was the mother of his child.
Seriously.
And the child that was killed during a war precipitated by the father of the woman he announces he's going to marry. That's a big freaking deal. So if Jessica,
a kick in the gut is what it is.
It
yeah.
is. It is. And, yeah. it, and that is not, and that has to be cleaned up somehow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe we can get rid of the Leto II subplot altogether because that doesn't really enter into a whole lot of stuff. But there are things to come that need to be tidied up by making sure that we understand the relationships involved here. Because if Jessica was the one who tossed a monkey wrench into the Bene Gesserit genetics plan for the House of Treaties, Paul taking up with Chani and starting a family with her throws a whole hardware store of wrenches into those plans because she
right.
What's her genetic background? Nobody knows. She's from the desert. She's not part of the plan, and she's making babies with the Kwisatz Haderach, and that's mm-hmm. not a good thing for the Bene Gesserit.
One more thing about Chani that's kind of important.
Yeah.
Remember Dr. Keynes, the Imperial mm-hmm. Planetary Ecologist, Judge of the Change? Mm-hmm. Denis Villeneuve both gender and race swaps that character from book to movie.
Right.
In the book and in the David Lynch movie and in the miniseries, Dr. Keynes is a white guy. In Villeneuve's movie, Keynes is a black woman, which complicates matters because in the book, Dr. Keynes is not just treated as a revered prophet among the Fremen, he is also Chani's father, which they just blew out of the water. Like yeah. Denis Villeneuve said, no, we're not even going to consider who Chani's father is.
No.
So Dr. Keynes and his wife, who's also Chani's mother, named Farala, is, quote, a noted herbalist among the Fremen, unquote.
Because mm-hmm. when you have a novel, you can sort of explain the backstory of people.
Yeah,
and talk about their relationships. And
that
you
just
know,
wasn't necessary to the movie,
no.
apparently.
But,
right.
you know, Dr. Keynes can no longer be Chani's father. So
no,
sorry about that, kids.
It's a woman.
Because it's a lady. And a nice lady. There are other smaller changes that were clearly sacrificed for time, didn't affect our enjoyment of the movie at all. But they do contribute to the richness of the novel. So we can recommend that you read the novel because it's a really good novel. For example, did you know that Paul already had a family before he hooked up with Chani? I don't mean mom and Duke, etc. He had a family of his own. This is true. When he killed Jamis in their duel to the death, Paul inherited all of Jamis's possessions, his water and his coffee service and his wife and his children. This is Fremen custom. So Paul already has a family that he's responsible for in the novel, which is never mentioned in the movie. You might have noticed that after the Fremen all drew their knives, when Jessica got the drop on Stilgar, put a knife to his throat, and he said, peace, peace, woman, peace. Before they resheathed their blades, they all cut themselves on their wrists because, according to Freeman Warrior Code, which we mentioned before, an unsheathed Kris knife cannot be resheathed without drawing blood. Now, in the book, this tradition is foreshadowed early on when Shadow Mapes presents Jessica with the gift of a Kris knife, which we mentioned earlier.
Also in the book, Lady Jessica has much more room to be confident and assertive. She gets to reshape the household and win loyalties among the Fremen with her decisiveness and generosity. The movie doesn't allow the Jessica character much time for that kind of development. She's sort of at war almost from the beginning.
Yeah.
In the book, before open warfare begins, Duke Leto and Lady Jessica host a large dinner party, which is a really great scene in the book. Very memorable.
Mm-hmm.
And at this dinner party, the Empire's politics, alliances, economics, rumors, diplomacy, characters, families, etc. It's all on display.
All the backs. The part about Paul talking about drowning.
Yeah, yeah.
You mean on your planet you can drown? Yes, yes. Well, what happens? Well, and he talks about how people try to save themselves when they're drowning by climbing on each other's shoulders to mm-hmm. save themselves. And Paul says something about it being, you know, understandable when you're drowning, but it's kind of unseemly at a dinner party. And there's like, oh, Paul's getting with it. Paul understands some stuff.
Yeah. So this dinner party is, as I say, just a great scene. And it's a pity that it had to be cut, since it's where Paul's future wife, Princess Irulan, is introduced to other characters in the book.
Yeah.
We know her as the diarist who's telling the story.
Uh-huh.
But we don't know who she is or why she's interacting with the other people until this dinner party.
Yeah.
Right.
And she's introduced as the emperor's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So and she, I believe, breaks protocol by bringing Sardaukar like bodyguards to mm-hmm. the dinner party, which is, you know, just unprecedented. So we learn a lot from the dinner party. We don't lose much, but it was kind of a fun scene that we kind of missed in the movie. Now, I don't believe we mentioned the orgies yet, right, Blue Gal? The
no,
orgies.
We haven't mentioned the orgies, Dirk
yeah.
Glass.
Yeah. Denny, let's talk about orgies, okay? Let me take one pass at your next screenplay just to include some mention. Because, yes, there are orgies among the Fremen. One of the abilities of a Fremen Reverend Mother is the power to transform that water of life stuff, the stuff that comes out of the baby worm, which is lethal to anyone who is not trained or prepared to handle it, she can transform it into an aphrodisiac party drug, which on ritual occasions the Fremen drink, and they party and they screw all night long, which is definitely in the novel and definitely ain't in any of the movies.
Yep. So are we down on the movie because it doesn't have orgies? Because it doesn't have all the novel's bells and whistles, including some fairly important bells and whistles? Not at all. No. I am telling you, this movie is awesome. And you should stop listening to the podcast and go listen to it and go see it.
Right now.
At the biggest screen possible. Worth IMAX. Absolutely. We're going to go see it on IMAX for a second time. We saw it on regular screen first time. And after we saw it, I was like, okay, we got to go see this again on IMAX because it's big and amazing. All the little details are fully realized and sufficiently strange. The sound and power of lasers that can cut through mountains, the black and white of Harkonnen's Getty Prime under its, quote, black sun, unquote, is amazing, as are the ink blot-like fireworks. The whole cinematography of that planet is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Now, we weren't born when it was first released, but this movie feels like a lot like what The Wizard of Oz must have felt like to people seeing it for the first time.
Yeah, just boom.
On a big screen.
Yeah.
Or when audience went to see Lawrence of Arabia for the first time in 1962, or went to see 2001 A Space Odyssey in 1968. Even to a certain extent, Star Wars in the late 70s.
No. Yeah. Just, wow. That giant Imperial destroyer just crossing the screen forever.
Yeah.
Is just,
I thought about you and I have watched Superman, the old Christopher Reeve Superman, and the tagline, "You'll believe a man can fly."
Yeah.
"You'll believe a man can ride a sandworm."
Yeah, absolutely.
And your seats shake when these big ships land. The sound waves make for a physical experience that's overwhelming. It's spectacle, the soundtrack, all of it. It's just overwhelming. And the story itself, come on, it's terrific.
It's a terrific story. Yeah. And I liked... There's a whole bunch of this movie I liked a lot. And again, we're in spoiler territory, so this is in no particular order. I love the floating Sardaukar.
Oh, yeah.
Because when they jump out of their transports, they float to the ground. They don't parachute. They just float to the ground. And when they go up the side of a mountain, they go up like they're crossing the bottom of a swimming pool. They glide along right above the surface of the mountain, pushing along on their fingertips. And it's just so gentle and elegant. I love the fact that the Fremen are under the desert. Mm-hmm, that their secret to surprise attacks is burying themselves in the sand, even though there's a monstrous harvester coming their way and popping out of the sand in the middle of the bad guys and wiping them out that way. I love the mines. What you call the refrigerator door mines?
Mm-hmm.
The big magnetic plates that are under the sand that when they get close enough, which I don't think was in the novel. But the depth to which everyone involved in this movie looked into it and said, let's make everything as cool and weird and specific as possible. And they did. The lasers, these are not laser blaster guns. These are thin little beams of light that make a needle sound that you can hear right through your bones that can blow through a mountain or cut through an entire harvester, etc. The noises are big. There's epic battles. There's individual combat scenes, and there's a lot of human drama, all of which goes really well. However, there is one issue we should probably talk about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we got to talk about the white savior thing.
Yeah, we kind of do that.
Yeah.
Now, on the surface, Dune reads like a typical white savior story. He's from a colonial superpower. He becomes involved with the indigenous people that are being exploited by the colonial powers. He's better at them at all sorts of things. He learns from them, becomes like them, but eventually he rises to become their leader and he helps set them free. And that's the white savior story. It's a bad story. It's creepy and wrong. And it's a fair point to say that about Dune if you're only analyzing the surface. But if you read the entire series, you'll see that really it isn't that, because Paul isn't the hero. There really aren't any heroes in this story, except maybe the Fremen as a people. The religion of the Fremen was invented by the Bene Gesserit to control them. In fact, they invented this religion to control everybody. They put a variation of this myth into every culture in the galaxy so that they can control everything. And the Fremen are like characters in other Herbert books, like I read the Dosadai Experiment. There's probably a few others. They've been subject to generations of repression and privation and genocide on a planet that is barely habitable. And those who that survived generation to generation and adapted have become incredibly strong and resilient and ferocious. As a people, as a group, they are a terrible weapon. They are better fighters than even the Emperor Sardaukar, who are trained in similarly harsh conditions. Now, Paul is the end product of thousands of years of very careful genetic manipulation by the Bene Gesserit, who've been trying to create what they call the Kwisatz Haderach, a male Bene Gesserit who would have access to the memories of both male and female ancestors, as well as an ability to see the future.
Right, and as the spice on Arrakis begins to trigger some of Paul's latent ability, he sees that the only way to defeat the Emperor and free the Fremen would be to take on the role of the Messiah in their religion and turn a Fremen army loose on the galaxy. Now, a big core thing in this movie is his struggle fighting against this fate that he has long as he can, until at last he can see no other way forward that doesn't destroy everything. He envisions this very narrow path that might avert complete disaster, but he has always has these visions of a million people dying around him.
Billions. Billions dying.
And he doesn't want that to happen.
Right.
He and Chani and the Fremen are all trapped by events that they didn't create and don't want. This is all the doing of centuries of imperial domination and Bene Gesserit manipulation. And the only way out of the trap is terrible. But every other alternative appears to be worse. So Paul is forced into this choice. And of course, there are critics, nitpicks, but they are very much the same kind of nitpicks that happened when the Lord of the Rings trilogy was adapted for the screen by Peter Jackson, and with HBO's Game of Thrones series, and with the Harry Potter series, and on, anything that is adapted from a book, stuff's going to get left out. And no one feels the pain of leaving out beloved scenes and characters more deeply than the director, who loves this book. And he's making those decisions. Denis Villeneuve has loved the Dune series since he was a kid, and that is so blatantly obvious from this movie.
It is. It is.
Here's what he said in Entertainment Weekly last month.
Quote, "One of the most painful choices for me on this one was Thufir Hawat. He is a character I absolutely love, but I decided right at the beginning that I was making a Bene Gesserit adaptation. That meant that Mentats are not as present as they should be, but it's the nature of the adaptation," unquote. Remember, there are two more books in this trilogy, in the original trilogy, Dune Messiah and Children of Dune. Now, Villeneuve has already signed up for making Messiah, and since this is really one single long epic story, who knows, maybe some elements of Children might be incorporated into the Messiah movie. And since Children is right there in the title, you know for sure somebody's going to be out there making babies. And when royal babies are involved, the Bene Gesserit are never far behind. So to a director like Villeneuve, who's clearly had the whole picture of the arc of the story in mind all along, it just makes sense, as painful as it is, to prune down the subplots and characters who are less critical to the main story.
All right, can I talk for a minute about two areas where, while I was watching the movie, I went, okay.
Absolutely.
I did adore this movie. I want to say again.
Same here. Same here. Yep.
The credits start rolling and I'm just like, holy mackerel. This is amazing. I want to see it again. Mm-hmm. Blew my mind. The two areas where, you know, we drove out of the parking lot and I'm going, maybe if I had editorial control over this movie, which I should never have.
Mm-hmm.
Austin Butler as Fade Rautha is wonderful.
Yes, he is.
A perfect villain. He's got no body hair. Bald and no eyebrows and so forth. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, the cinematography of his planet, black and white, stark, fascistic, Leni Riefenstahl movie, you know, it's a Hitler rally, right?
Right.
And it's also a gladiator,
yes,
you know, murder story, right? Big, big, huge audiences. And other people have said that. The gladiator type thing with the massive crowds that go on as far as the eye can see, you know that's CGI.
Of course.
You know that's, you know, computer generated. Mm-hmm. Just football field after football field of bald heads cheering. Okay. That's a little over the top. And his section of the movie, I felt, although Austin Butler, as I said, is an incredibly menacing character, well played as a bad guy. Mm-hmm. It went on for a little long. There was, you know, he has no body hair, but there's a lot of mustache twirling going on here.
Yes, there is.
And then I'm going to show you my lack of eyebrows now. You know, and we get it. He's a bad guy. He's going to be the villain from the moment he appears. Mm-hmm. But it just sort of dragged on a little bit. Although I really liked how his relationship with his uncle in that gladiator scene, who was his uncle is up in his own balcony, you know, the Harkonnen, Baron Harkonnen, in this tiny little slit in the area of the, I don't know what you'd call it, the
Colosseum.
Yeah, the Colosseum, right, looking down. But they're connected. You know they're connected with they have an evil bond. And his uncle is there to watch him murder everybody.
Right.
That's what's going to happen. But that whole thing just went on a little bit long. The other thing is about the sandworms. Everyone talks about this. The most exciting thing is when Paul learns to ride a sandworm. And that scene, even the harshest critics of this movie admit, this is just amazing. Then the sandworms become a train service.
Yes.
And are being ridden by 15 people. And the princess is in a... the princess, the mother, Paul Modib's mother,
yeah,
Jessica, is riding in a basket on mm-hmm. the sandworm, surrounded by people. And they've all found a way to get on that sandworm. And mm-hmm. there's six of them riding in tandem to go south, like it's a public transit. And when that happened, I was kind of, oh, really? it's not random. Are these things scheduled? Are you able to pick one up? That ride of six sandworms and everybody riding together mm-hmm. in parallel, I had a hard time suspending disbelief at that moment. I understood why they all had to go south at once and that they had to cross the desert and they had mm-hmm. to cross the desert on sandworms, but putting them all on sandworms riding parallel to one another, diminished the menace of the sandworms as dangerous human-eating monsters, which is what they are for most of the movie.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they're you know, the L train yeah. that can ride south. Yeah.
And they're all the Fremen. First of all, to be a Fremen, you have to be able to ride a sandworm. That's the test. So mm-hmm. every one of them, down to the youngest, I'm not sure how young it goes, probably 10 or 11, has to be able to take their hooks out mm-hmm. and climb up on a worm and ride. And mm-hmm. and once you do that, once you've done that, you you keep it above the sand by holding its flaps open so its mm-hmm. skin is exposed to the sand, and it wants to stay above the sand.
Oh, okay.
That's how it operates. So you hook in below the plates of its skin and lift them up to create an irritant, and it wants mm-hmm. to stay away from the irritant so it stays. And then everybody else climbs on board. Because you've hooked up this transit system and you can put 10, 20, 30, 100, 200 people on a sandworm. It's gigantic. And ride it for a great deal of distance. The lining them up side by side, yeah, that was a bit of a cinematic thing. But they all do use sandworms for transportation.
Yeah.
And yeah. Nobody.
There's no explanation of how you get off a sandworm, though.
Oh, you just run it into the ground.
Oh.
You just ride it until either it's exhausted or you just lower it, and everybody rolls off and goes away. You got to stay out of its wake or it'll suck you under. But it's like riding a bronco. You know, at some point.
Yeah, okay.
It's riding a horse. It's riding a war elephant. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. they're not tame, but they can be harnessed. Mm-hmm. And they're definitely the most terrifying thing on that planet.
I just think it is a juxtaposition between a transit system and a monster that can eat you. Mm-hmm. That they really just sort of didn't explain or justify in some way, you know. So those are my only two quibbles. So
don't go see the movie. Just blow that movie off.
I think everybody should go see this. See both movies.
Yeah. Oh, and I would like to see them back to back, honestly. I mean, that's 6 hours. Yeah. That's a long
time. They'll do it.
But honestly, it's worth it. It gives me hope that there are directors out there who know how to take science fiction material and make them into something for adults to enjoy and think about.
Because that's what made this movie great to me. This is a movie for adults. Yeah.
There's a lot to think about in this movie.
Yep.
First of all, again, there's no democracy in this movie at all. This is a competition between forms of government that in this country we can't stand.
Right.
There's no freedom per se. The Fremen are oppressed. It's run by royal houses. Nobody elects Duke Leto. Everyone loves Duke Leto, but nobody elected the guy. Mm-hmm. It's an inherited office. So there is this kind of Frank Herbert sense of, you know, if people hang around long enough, eventually they get tired of democracy and they go back to being, you know, an aristocratic system. Mm-hmm. And it's tragic that happens to human beings. And it's tragic what happens to native populations when colonizers show up. Because remember, Dune didn't always used to be this way. Mm-hmm. The planet didn't used to be a sand pit at the end of the galaxy. It was a place that was going to be terraformed and turned into a green. That's what the planetary ecologists are supposed to do. That's what the ecological stations are supposed to be. It was supposed to be transformed into, but then they discovered oil. Nope. Then they discovered spice. Mm-hmm. And you can't have spice without worms and without desert. Mm-hmm. So they decided to leave the planet as an arid, nearly unlivable wasteland forever and let the people there suffer forever. Mm-hmm. And the people living there have one dream, and that's the green paradise. That's the green paradise. They harvest water. I thought that the wind traps were excellent because those are also in the book.
Yeah.
Also, these little tricks you use to harvest water and get water out of the air, get water out of bodies. People drink the water they sweat out of their own suits a little bit more, but the bulk of the water is reserved to massive underground cisterns that no one would drink from because one day they're going to transform their planet into a green paradise.
Yep.
And they're saving the water underground to do that. Yeah. They're sacrificing for generations so that in the future their great-great-great-grandchildren can live on a green planet.
Well, and their great-great-great-great-grandfather's body water will water that planet.
Will water that.
Yeah. And that is remarkable.
And what's the problem with that? Water kills worms.
Yep. Yep.
And so you can't have spice and a green paradise at the same time. In the book, in the literature, some people try to take worms off world and raise them elsewhere and nothing works.
Yeah.
It's this one place under these circumstances. And you know what? If millions of people have to suffer and die and be oppressed and hunted so that we can have oil to run, so that we can drive cars and do all things.
Yeah. I mean,
that's just unfortunate.
It is apples to apples, a comparison of the Middle East. It is in that regard. Yeah. Yeah.
So take your own lessons from it. You know what? We really do enjoy, in addition to Dune movies and Dune books and Dune miniseries, we really enjoy these Tuesday podcasts. They're fun. We enjoy No Fair Remembering stuff most of the time and science fiction some of the time. But we also really do need more Patreons to make this viable. So on this Super Tuesday, if you can spare $5, please spare $5. Remember, Spice is worth billions of credits. Out of all those billions of credits that Spice can raise, all the money that Shom corporations have, all we're asking are for a few shekels, a few pennies, a few pfennigs, $5. And visit our Patreon at patreon.com/proleftpod. And thank you for doing that. And I hope you've enjoyed this crossover episode between No Fair Remembering Stuff and Dune.
We had to drop everything and talk about Dune too, because it's an awesome movie.
Well, and you should know that that's what my wife said, because we're going through all the list of things that for No Fair Remembering Stuff, because that's what this normally is. And she said, you know what? Let's just do Dune.
We just saw this movie. It's just the greatest movie ever. And let's do it.
We already did a Dune podcast once for the first half. Let's just do Dune. Like, this sounds great. Let's drop everything and do that. Let's do that. And honestly, the color returned to my face. My posture improved. And
I suddenly read his mind.
I felt young again. It's when the universe was new. And I hope you've enjoyed this half as much as I have, because this has been a blast.
We're doing Tuesday podcasts for fun for us, and we hope they're fun for you. Yeah. And we thank you so much for your financial support through Patreon or through PayPal. All of the details are at proleftpod.com and how you can support us, and we really appreciate it. See you next time.
See you next time.